is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So we're doing Megillat Esther lessons for today. Tonight is Mish, and Esther was taken, so she'll talk to us about that in a second. Before we begin, I just want to thank our sponsors for the Purim series, Jay and Hoti Pomerantz. Thank you so much. And I want to ask Jay to come up and say a few words in memory of his mother. Jay is a former board member of Pardes. Jay and Hoti are longtime supporters, and we're really honored. So,
well, this is quite a surprise. Hold on while I get out my sheet here. This will be, I know we all came to hear Mish, not me, so this literally will be 2 minutes. And every time we have one of these kickoff sessions, what I try to do is link my mom, the topic, and Pardes. So what I wanted to just focus on is the fact that I love Megillat Esther because the characters have a real sense of reality and complexity. And as we all know, the name of God does not appear in the Megillah. And I think that is so that we can get a really unvarnished behavior of the characters who do things they wouldn't normally do. Now, the complexity I'm talking about, I will demonstrate through Esther and Mordechai. What we have is, first of all, Esther, who a tzadeket, who does give herself up to save the Jewish people. But we do have a side as well. She has a relationship with the king. She sleeps with the king. And she is not criticized in the Megillah. The Talmud does mental gymnastics to have it become a kosher activity. So we do have here a complex situation. We have Mordechai, who is pious, will not bow down to Haman. But if you look at the last few verses in the Megillah, it says, Mordechai HaYehudi, Mishneh LaMelech, Mordechai was the second in command or assistant to the king, Gadol LaYehudim, a leader of the Jews, V'ratzui L'rov Echav, and accepted by most of his brethren, not all. He had negatives as well. One of the commentators says that he basically was too much of a palace man. He would not stand up to the authorities. Unlike in the Green Book, Dr. Terry? Anybody see the Green Book? What's his name, the musician? Dr. Shirley at the end, where he stands up and says, I'm not going to play if I can't eat here. Mordechai really does suck up to the king. Now, what I like about it is that we see that these are people who are complex because they are people. And it gives us a picture of what life is like. My mother was a remarkable, outrageous, complex personality. And as the years pass, my sisters and I appreciate more and more her lack of conformity. And if my mother had been in the Megillah, she would have been the star, and Ahasuerus and Haman would not have had a chance against her smarts and personality. And to bring this finally to Pardes, my mother would have been completely at home in Pardes, where contradictions, where difficulties and complexity in no way are avoided, but are the basis for an open and rich culture of learning. Thank you very much. That wasn't so long.
Thank you so much, Jay. It's really an honor to teach in your mother's memory. I want to thank everyone who made it here tonight on behalf not just of myself and of Jay's mom, but also all of the people who just said, can I listen to it on tape? And you guys are the ones who are here to, like, keep me awake and get me going tonight. And all of the rest of the people are going to be listening to the Pardes live feed, which will probably be coming out in the next few days. So they thank you. I reservation about this class. I'm just going to say up front, as I said last week, that I'm giving my two raciest classes, and this is a class that I've given a few times, but I've never given in Jerusalem. It's a very... I need to tell you that this is the holiest city in the world and that God lives here, and I'm afraid of getting struck by lightning, but I'm not going to say anything that's not in the text and that's not said with just love of Torah. So I want to say that I am I'm a rabbi and I'm a social justice activist. First and foremost, I am a lover of Torah, so I want to just make sure that I start with the Purim piece, and then we'll come around to the consent culture, sexuality, and selling sex. So Esther. This is going to be the part that is really hard when I give this abroad, and here you guys just take it, get it. It's easy for you. Esther's not a Jewish name. She has a Jewish name. What is her Jewish name? Hadassah, but she uses this name Esther, which means it means hidden. It means hidden. So the question is, what's coming at that from that hiddenness? I think the most common answer is where Jay started, the hiddenness of God. Poor Hester Panim. God is high. This is the only book in the Bible where God does not appear by name. And it's a holiday that is very explicitly about exile, about darkness, about how to respond when we don't see God easily in our lives. And Esther wrestles with that. What does it mean to not see God directly in her life? And she drags God from the heavens into our world. And I think that that's an incredible model for us. And that's really going to be the moral of the class of where we're going in the end, but it's a long road in between. There's another sense to the word Hester, of hiddenness. And you probably are going to get to it. I've heard Michael Eisenberg before, so I'm imagining he's going to get there. Esther is really, not only is it not a Jewish name, it's really a not Jewish name. Esther and Mordechai have this remarkable sound of Ashtera and Marduk, the major gods of the Persian culture, it's like naming your kid Christian. The first boy I had a crush on, Christian. And my mom, wow, she was in a panic. She's in a panic now too. So it's all. that's right. We can. to name yourself that name, and we know that she keeps her identity concealed. And why would you want to hide your? Why would you want to hide your identity? It's dangerous. Okay, it was like, oh my gosh, this is 2019. Have I read the newspaper this week to see about, how, if we would talk about anytime they're not going to be able to see that you're Jewish, are they? It's going to be, because it's so dangerous everywhere we go. Surely she was keeping her identity a secret because it was dangerous, or perhaps she wanted to pass, right, to be able to succeed. And I think we need to think about what that could mean, and that's going to be a theme. We're going to hold on to it and come back to it. I think these two aspects of the hiddenness of Esther and God both being hidden, I'm not sure exactly how precisely they're connected, but I hope they are connected, and we have to get back to them. So there's always mystery in the Torah. We'll come back and be connect with them. I'm so so happy to be teaching this class here in Jerusalem. The starting point of this class with the subtitle, Sexuality, Consent, Culture, and Trafficking. I want to thank Daniel Roth, who is the director of the Conflict Resolution, Peace and Conflict Studies track here. I'm sorry if I got that wrong a little bit. At Pardes has invented, who else has invented a Jewish holiday and has thousands or tens of thousands of people celebrating the 9th of Adar? And he has given us this tool of machloket matters, how to have civil dialogue using Torah as a way to take an issue that's contemporary and that's really touchy and to step back from it one step and think about it in a new way with the help of Torah. And he suggests this source from Midrash Psalms. Rabbi Yannai said, the Torah was not given in clear-cut manner. Rather, on every statement God said to Moses, he would say 49 reasons the matter could, that's not on your sheet, only me. 49 reasons the matter could be pure and 49 reasons why the matter could be impure. And part of Torah is to be able to understand there are so many reasons why this is right and there are so many reasons why this is right. And sometimes Torah, by using Torah, we can really explore truth in the world. And I picked a social justice issue that I've been exploring also with the help of, I wear two hats at Pardes. I wear a bunch of hats at Pardes, but two of the hats I wear at Pardes are the director of the social justice track, which is very self-consciously trying to, I feel separated from you. It's, sorry, you guys. Very self-consciously bring Torah to the streets, to bridge the space between the Beit Midrash and Torah and see how the streets of Jerusalem, the streets of this beautiful Jewish country in which we live, can teach us new faces to Torah and how Torah can bring so much power to the Jewish state. And one of the issues that I've studied in that context and also in the context of another of my hats, which is our weekly volunteer work, Pardes, a weekly engagement, which I also supervise at Pardes, is the question of selling sex. There's a disagreement amongst feminists, really kosher feminists. Okay, on the one hand, you've got that between the what they call themselves abolitionists and decriminalizationist activists. And there's great feminists on both sides. You've got on the side of the abolitionists, Catherine McKinnon, Andrea Dworkin, Gloria Steinem, Nicholas Kristof, Cheryl Dunn. You can't. Like, those are kosher feminists, and you can hear from the language of abolitionists, right? What does it mean, abolitionists? It means that working in sex is by definition, they would call it, every time I would use the word prostitute, they would cross it out and they would say prostituted woman, okay? There's the line between someone, no one chooses to sell sex, and even if they chose to sell sex in the first place, the conditions of selling sex are not what they are so harsh. And then on the other hand, the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, American Jewish World Service, they are what they call they're in favor of decriminalization. I'm going to read few sentences from this decriminalization activist, Arfa Norda. She said, do you know that there are hundreds of thousands of women doing sex work in Thailand? In the world, there are millions of us. Everyone has parents or children or families. We fund our young sisters' study at university. We pay for children's schooling. We support our uncle to travel overseas to work. We enable our older brother to join military service, and we provide our parents to go to the hospital if they're sick. This is one level of sex worker leadership, sex worker leadership within our families. Usually, if a man is looking after his family in this way, we call him the head of a family, don't we? Yet I also do this. Will you call me the head of a family? Will you call me the head of a family? Look at the double standard. Of course, women are coming to most people are coming to sex work from a very limited set of choices. But we're would I like to live in a world where no one has to do sex work? Absolutely. This is Liesl Gernholz, the executive director of the Women's Race Division at Human Rights Watch. Would I like to work in a world where no one has to do sex work? Absolutely, but that's not the case. So I want to live in a world where women can do it largely voluntarily in a way that is safe. If they're raped by a police officer or a client, they can lay a charge and know it will be investigated. This is so powerful, right? Like, how can you object to this? Their kid won't be expelled from school. Their landlord won't kick them out. Decriminalization of sex work could have the largest effect on the course of the HIV epidemic. By increasing access to condoms and medical treatment, governments can free themselves to crack down on trafficking and underage prostitution, human rights advocates argue, if they stop arresting consenting adults. I'm sorry. and she adds, sex work isn't inherently immoral or demeaning. It can even be authentically feminist. Put this quote at the top of my source sheet. Once you've done it, you always know. When it comes down to, I have everything I need to survive. And that is powerful. I feel that as a deep truth, a painful truth. But there's another truth, the truth of McKinnon, Dworkin, abolitionists consciously invoking the battle to end slavery, as well as the one for equality. If prostitution is legal and men can buy women's bodies with impunity, it's the extreme sexualization of women. We're sexual objects. What does that mean to how we're seen in a professional context? If women are sex toys and that you can buy, think about the impact on relationships between men and women, in marriage and otherwise. McKinnon talks about prostituted women who have no say at all in the kind of sex they're having, the number of partners they have, and the kinds of protection that they're using, and have to serve dozens of clients a night. Women in prostitution told me they serve 20 to 30 men a day on average with no choice. So do the math. Each woman serves as many as 8,000 men a year. That's, it sounds very extreme. So I did a little bit of the math myself from the decriminalization numbers, meaning I took the number of the decriminalization people who work in Amsterdam in legal contexts, the non-white women, because of course non-white women may command a lower hourly rate than white women. And if you work in the red light district, you need to serve at least 6 clients a night to cover expenses, just to pay your rent. And then after that, you start to make money. That's where it's legal and protected. But one of the things we know about sex work is that wherever there's a legal industry, like the red light the red light district, it creates underneath it an illegal, a black industry that is where the women are less protected, where there's more trafficking, where there's more violence, more drugs, and so the line between trafficking and choice is a very elusive one in practice. So happy to be giving this, not just because I'm here, I am in Jerusalem, and last week I was in America, which is for sure. I am so happy to be here and not in America, but also because we, in America, in most cases, the criminal is the woman who's selling sex, and she's the victim, and the man, and that's where the focus is. And Israel has recently passed a law, and we've even promised to fund the law next year, which really is amazing, that prostitution has, that purchasing sex has become illegal, a criminal act, and women who sell sex are to be considered victims, to be offered rehabilitative services, and we're funding those services, and the men who purchase sex services are the criminals, and that's a new law here. It's an adoption of the Nordic law, the Nordic model, and that's something that Pardes volunteers worked on for a number of years in the context of their volunteer work, and I am very happy that we've passed that law. And I think it's sort of, and I think that's the right thing for here. But I'm not. I take very seriously the work of AJWS and the Human Rights Watch, and I wonder if maybe there's different answers for different places, or if we need to think about it. But I've looked to this issue. I want to take this issue, which I think is a very raw issue, and they set up this incredible binary. Both these feminists that I admire, the abolitionists, who sort of say women who sell sex are victims. They're prostituted women. Okay, prostituted women. There's like, you can't, you have to, they're passive victims all the time. And sex heroes from the decriminalization perspective. And so what they've set up is this binary, and that's the binary that I want to explore today, is can we say either you're a victim or you're a protagonist and nothing in between. And what I want to explore is to bring that lens, that question, to the Torah, to the Megillah, and break down that binary a little bit to look for a third way. And I think it will help us read the Megillah. It first of all, will help. I know that it's going to help us talk about sexuality, consent, culture, and trafficking. But I think it's also going to help us read the Megillah in a different light and think about the characters in a different way. And so I think that that's the exercise that I want to bring you with right now, for you to join me in that exploration now. So that's the question. Okay, that's the framing question. And with that framing question, you could go back to sources that you've read 300 times, maybe 3,000 times, maybe that you know by heart, and read them with different eyes, I think. So I'm going to give you a little, Pardes is all about Chavruta. I have a very strong reading today, meaning like, you know, it's not, I have something that I want to share with you, but I know that you will bring new readings that will help inform me. So I'm going to invite you to start on page 2, okay, with chapter 2. I'm going to give you 5 minutes in Chavruta to read with those eyes. Is Esther a victim? Is Esther a sex hero? In what ways is she either both of those? And what can we think what can we learn about selling sex from that perspective? Okay, obviously selling sex is illegal, is against halacha. In the context of a limited set of choices. Okay, on your record, set, go. Read out loud. Thank you. Okay, people are having too much fun. Let's say we're going to I want to do 15 minutes on the traditional narrative, which the traditional narrative is Esther as a sex hero. Okay, that's the traditional narrative. And then we'll do 15 minutes on Esther as a victim, and then we'll put it all together. Okay, so let's I want to actually start with that where we started. Start again where we started with Lo higida Esther et amavet moladata ki Mordechai tzivala asher lo tagid. She didn't tell where she's from. Okay, it's not just that she didn't. Mordechai, she has a name, Esther, that isn't an outside name, but she also does not reveal her people or her kindred, for Mordechai had told her not to reveal it. Okay, so we suggested fear as a possibility of why she would keep it a secret. The Gemara takes it in another direction. Anyone want to suggest it? What? Let's see, on page 4. Source number 7. Judah says, Hadassah was her name. Why then was she called Esther? Lamani kreit shma Esther, al shem shehaita masteret vareha. She concealed the facts about herself. Shenemar ein Esther megedet etama. V'yas hamelech mishteh gadol. Ava, the king made a great feast. He made a feast for her, and she did not tell him who she was. He remitted taxes, and she did not tell him. He sent gifts, and still she did not tell him. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, he went and took counsel of Mordechai. The way to rouse a woman is to make her jealous, and even so, she did not tell. Okay, do you see what's going on? She is, it's part of a conspiracy. She doesn't tell because that's what she's got. Think about what it's like to be the king, okay? It's cool, I bet, to be the king, but it's probably also boring. He has a mess of women, every night a different woman, and she doesn't, it's not an easy life, even with Esther as a sex hero, it's not a pretty life. They have a year to prepare for their big night with the king. And then one night with the king, they can bring anything with them that they want to bring to the king that one night. And then they go to the Beit HaPilakshim, to the house of the concubines, and they never come back unless they're called by name. Okay, so what are you going to bring with you to meet the king on your one night? This is it. Because you know you don't leave the Beit HaPilakshim and then start another life. This is you go to waste away in the Beit in the house of the concubines. So you've got one chance with the king. You want to be remembered. So you bring something fancy. You've got a great outfit. You've got a dance thing. You have some sort of business card that's appropriate to the job. And what does she bring to her business card? Nothing. She brings nothing. Okay? We could understand that in multiple ways. What are the ways we could understand that? Why does she bring nothing? To be mysterious. She's confident in herself. I might have said she's not really excited to go to the king and she just wants to slip into the background and not be noticed. Okay, but I thought you would say that. But she wants to be mysterious. I think that's the word, that's the assumption that Mordechai seems to have. Is like, let's play hard to get. Let's play a little hard to get. And that's actually something the king doesn't get a lot of. He does it, and so he's dying, and it's working. The Gemara has it working on the king. He's dying to know who she really is. And he's willing to do whatever. whatever's necessary in order to figure it out, and it's not working. And he's even taking counsel with Mordechai. Help me figure out how to get under this woman. And Mordechai's playing along, right? Like trying to, this is what you could do to really get Esther going and get her to, so she brought whatever he told her to bring. Nothing. Yeah. Right. We don't know. Okay, fine. This is a strong reading. Ailey's saying maybe it could have. Maybe she brought something else. Maybe she did bring a certain routine. Do you want to suggest something too? So I'm saying that is definitely, Mordechai didn't want it. She didn't want to be there. She was trying to slip into the background. Definitely a possible reading. The whole point of this class, by the way, is to show there's multiple possible readings. We're going to read this one reading, and then we're going to read this one reading, two different readings. But you see that the Gemara adopts Alan's reading, okay? She wants to be mysterious. She's trying to get him going. And this comes up again in the series of banquets, right? In chapter 5, you see Esther takes source number 5, chapter 5. Esther, Mordechai pressures Esther. I'm just jumping ahead, summarizing a little more because we have such wide variety of backgrounds in this room. Esther sends back, Mordechai is telling Esther, take care of us, it's all on you. And Esther sends back to Mordechai, we're gonna fast, and if I perish, I perish. And Mordechai has everybody fasting, and on the third day, Esther puts on royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. Nochach Beit HaMelech, VaMelech Yosheva Kisei Melchotoba Beit HaMalchut Nochach Petach HaBait. He's sitting on his royal throne in the throne room facing the entrance of the palace. V'yehi Kirot HaMelech Etet Hester HaMalcha Umedet B'chatzer Nasachen Be'inav V'yoshet HaMelech Lester Et Shervit HaZahav Asher B'yado V'tikrav Esther V'tiga B'rosh HaShervit. Esther extended, the king extended to, as soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won his favor. The king extended to Esther the golden scepter which he had in his hand. And Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. This is a very thinly veiled phallic symbol. What troubles you, Queen Esther? The king asked her. What is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be granted to you. And she could have said, save me and my people, I'm desperate. But instead of saying that, she says, if it pleases you, let the majesty and Haman come today to the feast that I've prepared for him. Okay, come tomorrow and I'll tell you. Why doesn't she tell him right there? She's building up the suspense, the mystery. Again, it's the same technique of the mystery. When she comes there, I want to make sure I do this in 15 minutes. When she comes there the next day, he and Haman come, and she doesn't tell him again. She says, come tomorrow, you and Haman, to another one, and then I'll tell you what you want, which Rashi says, what does it mean, and then I'll tell you? Tomorrow, source number 8, tomorrow I will do the king's bidding. What you've been asking from me all the time, to reveal my people and homeland, okay? What you've been wanting all the time is for me to give away my secrets. And she is, like, holding it out to him, saying, no, I can't tell you, no, I can't tell you. And what she means by no, I can't tell you is, ask me later. Okay, she's creating a lot of desire this way. And also with the banquets on it, why is she bringing Haman with her every time? but to make him jealous. Okay, in America they always say, well, you have to be ready to kill him right away. You have because we want to keep our enemies very close to us, because he's the person that we have to single out. Yes, but also because of the jealousy, that is what keeps Achashverosh up at night. What, I've been invited to a menage a trois with the but it's crazy. That seems to be the it's crazy. That's how it comes off. And she's saying to the king, not now, I'll tell you later. Not now, you can have it later. And what she means is, keep asking me, right? She keeps saying no, and she means keep asking me. I think this is really, it works so good. She really is a master of, she's a sex hero. She's the traditional sex hero. She uses her sex to get what she needs on behalf of the entire Jewish people. She saves us. And by the way, we have page one is the whole list of all the sex heroes we have in our tradition. We have like a long list of female heroines who are sex heroes. You know that women are obligated to read Megillat Esther, and many communities will have a mixed reading or a women's reading because they too were in that miracle. That statement of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi that women were afhen hayubo tohanes is the same story that they make about Hanukkah, because Hanukkah also, there was a female hero, Yehudit. She also used her sex and saved the Jewish people. And so too in with the four cups, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says the same line, afhen hayubo tohanes, the same situation, the women went out into the fields and seduced their husbands. It seems so immodest, but it was the right thing to do. When you have an extremely limited set of tools in your toolbox, you're allowed to use the tools you have, and we'll make a holiday for you afterwards. We will make a holiday for you, okay? She is a sex hero. There's no question about it. She's a sex hero. Is she selling her sex? Look at source number 10. V'tilakach Esther el melech Achashverosh, mitzaleh belikuchin, dein amar ane yehev mea dinarin va'alil ima, v'dein amar ane hiv tartin mea va'alil ima. Esther was taken to the king Achashverosh. What does it mean that she was taken? It said that earlier also. It means that she excelled mitzaleh belikuchin. Not only was she taken, but she was really great with the clients, likuchim, with the likuchot, with the clients. This one says, I'll give you 100 dinar to accompany her to the king. This one says, I'll give you 300 to take her to the king. Oh my gosh. Okay, she's for sure a sex hero. I just want to point out here that her sex methodology is to say no when she means ask me later. I think that, and it works really great. I think that it's important for us to think about that in consent culture, because if women want to use that tool, and women use that tool, we've been taught to use that tool, we're being taught in this book to use that tool, then we have to think again about, this is a funny clip, this is a funny group, but now I'm talking to the people that are listening to this on their podcast. You people that are listening to this on the podcast, I think we have to think again about what consent, obviously, yes means yes and no means no. And yet, if we use sometimes no to mean ask me later, then both the man and the female, that we have to have a serious conversation about what does it mean when sometimes we use no to mean ask me later, and what we mean is ask me later. I'm not saying that this does not in any way justify, and I'm saying this to everybody, that does not in any way justify pushing past that line. But we have to be sophisticated when we start, we can't just say yes means yes, no means no, and then also use that tool. If we want to use that tool, then we have to get a little bit more, we have to have more sophisticated conversations. So either we're going to give up that tool or we're going to have a more sophisticated conversation or something in between. I think it's important to have that conversation. But, okay, that's on sex, that's on consent culture. And I think it's a really important conversation. I think it's really important for us to recognize that Esther here saves the Jewish people. She uses her sex. It's great. I want to put on the other lens, okay? It's a hard lens for me to look at Esther as a victim. But just to summarize, sorry. So because obviously Esther did the right thing. From the beginning to the end, Esther does the right thing. Some of that is difficult for women. Her magic is manipulation. She's sexy and she's smart. She knows how and when to use her sex, her sexiness. Consent culture is out the window because she says no. And she means ask me later. The whole point of no is to elicit an ask me later. Does that make consent culture bad? Obviously not. It just problematizes the legislation and makes the male's job, it makes everybody's job that much harder. Okay. Sex, that's what, point one, point two, sex isn't dirty. All of our heroines used it and celebrated it, and according to Rashi, that's why we're included, okay? That's why we got the holiday, because we used our sex, and it was good. So Esther's a sex hero. We should legalize prostitution. Okay, I'm closing. I'm holding on to that, and I'm turning to, it's obvious to me and to all of you that the choices not just of Esther, but of everyone, of every woman in this in the ancient world were extremely limited, okay? The Esther is chosen to be the protagonist, as I go to the next 15 minutes, Esther's chosen to be the protagonist because she represents the exilic Jew. She is an orphan, and she is a female, and so that victim, and they're in the diaspora, and they have to hide their identity. That force in that world was a given for every woman. Who knows how many people got to choose their partner. And we see what happened to Vashti, right? She too, like the slightest resistance, because what was it that she said? I don't want to come naked before the king. You dearly. But and when we go back to the first chapter, to the second chapter, there's no question that the collection, to me it's obvious. I guess that the people who are dressing up as Esther for Purim are not thinking about it this way. You know, but like this, but Esther brought to the king, there's a reason why Hegai Saris HaMelech is Shomer HaNashim. You know, the women need a guard. You know, so who's the guard for? The guard is to keep the women in, okay? The women, this is really nothing less than state-sponsored rape, and the Gemara makes that very clear. It's just the taking of the women is state-sponsored rape. And the power of the king is demonstrated by his domination of women. That's the point, right? He does it on purpose to show, I'm the boss, I'm going to take all the women I want, and that way everyone will know I'm really king because I can dominate my wife even more than you can dominate your wife, right? That's his model. Okay, it's disgusting. I want to put on the lens of what I've looked from thinking about abolitionism and victims of prostitution is to go back to the really Mordechai. Esther is an incredible victim. She was, verse 7. Vihi omenet hadasa hi Esther bat dodo, ki en la avveim, vanara yafat tor, vetovat mareh, ubiyamot avia vima, velakcha mordechai lo levat. She was foster he was foster father to Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was shapely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordechai adopted her as his own daughter. Some of you know this Gemara already, but I want to look at it with slightly different eyes. Okay, source number 9. Probably most of you know this Gemara. I think it's important to read from the beginning. Ben Azai Omer, Esther lo arukah velo ktsaraita, ela benonit kadasa. She was neither tall nor short, but of medium size, like a myrtle. Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha, Omar, Esther yirak roket haita, v'chut shel chesed mashuch aleha. She was kind of green, sallow, but endowed with great charm, which was both of these are a way of saying she was really nothing special on the beauty camp. It will hold that. For she had neither father nor mother. And it continues. And when her father and mother died, right, there's something that, as you know, the Torah doesn't use 6 words when it could say it in 2 words. Ki ein la, that she's bemot of, ki ein la aveim upamot avia vima lamali. Right? Why do you have to tell me twice that she doesn't have a mother and father? Amar of Acha, ibrata meit aviha, yeldata meita ima. When she was conceived, her father died. When she was born, her mother died. Bemot avia vima lakha Mordechai elo leba. That is to say that that Esther never knew her parents. Okay, she had no parents besides for Mordechai. She had no parents. She never met them. She never met her parents, as the Gemara understands it. And then the Gemara says, Mordechai lakcha lo levat, tana mishum Rebbe Meir, al tikri levat ela levait. V'chein hu omer, l'rash ein kol, ki im kipsa chat ktana asher kanayla. Okay, I can't make a lot out of the limud, but the Tana taught in the name of Rebbe Meir, read not for a daughter, ela for a bite. Not, she wasn't a bat, she was a bite. She was married. You're probably familiar with that, but that is to say that Esther was married to Mordechai. But to think about the combination of the two things, which are juxtaposed, they're part of the same Gemara, that Esther had no other parent except for Mordechai, and Mordechai married her too. And then put it in the context of the research. Because if you know anything, if you know anything about prostituted women, whether they choose to work in sex, or they're victims of sex, or they're trafficked women, I mean, this is crazy, because like you're totally forced into sex work, or you choose it of your free will, the chances are, depending on who you ask, but the lower estimates, 90%, the higher estimates, 100%, chances that you were abused sexually in your home. And now this is why I feel anxious about this shiur, because I don't want to put anything, this was what happened a long time ago, and I don't want to put our standards onto their standards. I just want to think about this from the perspective of Esther, and I think it's really painful. Okay, I'm not thinking about it, I'm not trying to accuse any of our Torah heroes. You have to think about it from Esther's perspective. Her father married her. She didn't have any other father. She had no one in her life. That the point of having a, this is why does it happen that women go into selling sex? Because they're taught that they have no value outside their sexuality, that the reason why they're loved is because of their sex. And therefore, they want to do whatever they can to get love, to get validation in the world. They want this is like you're gonna, Alan's gonna stone me, but I didn't make it up. It's in the Gemara, and you have to think about what that would be like for Esther, okay? Because now from Mordechai's perspective, he's protecting Esther, okay? He's saving her, but Esther is in an incredibly vulnerable position. She doesn't have any place in her life, nowhere in her life where she is safe from, where she's valued outside of her sexuality. And I think no matter how great Mordechai was as a husband, this must have been incredibly painful. And it's also just so stereotypical of what a victim of sex trafficking is. I want to add just a couple more pieces. One, is there anyone in this room whose parents, whose father or grandfather fled Russia to escape the Russian army? Okay. Now, we're all familiar with that. Of course, why do you have to desert the Russian army? Because they grab you and they take you in for 20 years, and you're like, yeah, it's just 25 years, and you never see your family, and it's terrible. But you know, despite the fact that we're lucky that our ancestors fled that. But not every Jewish boy was taken to the Russian army. If you had a shtetl of 300, they had a quota of 20 boys that they were supposed to produce over the course of power. Well, like if they had 300 boys that year, so 20 of them had to go into the army. Who went to the army of those 20 boys? The poorest ones went, of course, the ones who did not have protection, the ones who were weak, the victims. And I want to suggest, v'tilakach Esther, that Esther was neither too tall nor too short, but of medium size like a myrtle. She was sallow, endowed with great charm. She was nechon. She was beautiful. Let's say she was the most beautiful one. If you were married to, right? It's possible that with a little bit more protection, she could have avoided this fate. And it's possible that if we go back to that Gemara, to the Midrash at number 10, Esther was taken to the King Ahasuerus. She excelled with the clients. This one said, I'll give 100 dinar to accompany her. And this one said, I'll give 200 to accompany her. Who are they giving that 200 to accompany her to? I'm not going to say it out loud in the moment. Maybe it was Haggai the pimp. And maybe it was Mordechai, the sugar daddy. And I think that it's really easy to read the text as understanding that Mordechai visited every day to see how she was doing. Mordechai used his relationship with Esther to move things with Haman. And it's possible to see Esther really as just so painfully a victim of a brutal culture in which she lived, but really a brutal culture in which she lived. It's not, you know, like without the, and I'm sure Mordechai was trying to protect her. there was an interest. The interests are there. Okay? The interests are there. And you see that she fits into the stereotype in a way that's just too strong not to read and not to think about when you're reading the perspective, when you're reading not, I mean, of course, the Gemara wants you to feel how much Mordechai was a victim as well as Esther. But I don't want to, I'm not taking that away, but I want to see, to read the text not just through Mordechai's eyes, but also through Esther's eyes. And how did she experience it? And she was a victim. How was she what? Yeah, okay. She was marketed as a virgin. Even if, whether, I don't know. I don't have the answer to your question. But the Gemara answers that. You know, the Gemara is the one that's suggesting it. I'm not suggesting it. The Gemara is suggesting it. So, does that take away from her being a sex hero? In my mind, it doesn't take away from her being a sex hero, not one iota. And I think it actually brings us back to, it doesn't take away from her heroism, not one iota. And she was a victim. There's no question. The whole point of the story is that she is the paradigm, the ultimate victim. There is no one more victim than Esther. And you can see what her fate was. And from that place of terrible victimness, she steps up and saves the entire Jewish people using her sex. And to me, the moral of the story is that it's not either you're a sex hero or you're a helpless victim that we have to come and we have to come and help you. But it's possible to be a victim and still take charge of your life and bring God into the world and lehit labesh b'malchut, and to dress as a king and for God to come and help you. And that's the moral of the story. That there is no binary between victim and hero, but that it's possible for everyone to step into the world and be a hero, and we should reject that. We have to answer, we have to think about the question, what are we going to, it's obvious that the right answer is not that it should, that we should, that we should allow men to purchase sex services and villainize the women. Obviously, we need to cut. This one solution is to decriminalize and to protect them, and through the legal system. And the other possibility is to protect them. Baruch Atzaronai Ohenu Melech Olam Osem Maase Bereishit. Wow. Baruch Atzaronai Ohenu Melech Olam Shekocho Gvuratzo Malei Olam. I'd like to suggest is that it's possible to hold both of those things at the same time, and that is the moral of the Book of Esther, really, is that that whatever our situation is, we should try to look for ways in which we can have agency over our life, and agency means to invite God into our life and to look to God, and that God will come and help us in that context. So a lot has changed and a lot has stayed the same. We definitely see using your body and maybe even prostitution as a little bit of choice, a legitimate choice in the context of very limited choices. Limited choices are a real reality. Maybe back then, I think we have to like look now at what's happening in the sex market here. You know, to what extent can you talk about choice of being working in the sex industry, given what really serving 8 clients a day and the inevitability of drugs and force and violence in your life. And if If so, then perhaps it's... even if there are some people who might choose to sell sex because it does help them get through college, maybe we shouldn't allow those people to sell sex in order to get through college because it's going to lead to the victimization of other people. Either way, I want to just try to step out from that binary and to think about the question in a different way. I think that looking at this text, it helps me do that. It doesn't help me know the answer, but it helps me hold this answer as deeply true. It helps me hold that answer as deeply true, and it holds me try to think of a third way where I can try to wrestle with the complexity and the nuance of truth, even though ultimately halacha will have to come up with some sort of law. I'm happy that Israel has come up with some sort of law, and I hope that we will be blessed to implement it well, and to help women to get out of these very, very limited choices that unfortunately the weakest women in our society often fall prey to. And I hope that we will, those of us who find ourselves wherever we are, victimized in much smaller ways, please God, will also take strength from Esther and God, call God down into our world, and God will save us. I thank you very much. I'm going to take your comments, but thank you very much. I think we have time for a couple of comments. Or questions if people want. Toby and then Jay.
People have no choice. And when it's true that Esther was pushed in, but someone's blessed, she made a choice.
Because that choice is, how much of a choice? Yeah, that's a choice.
What I observed, and I like the sources you brought down, just one thing. Esther is at the beginning. She doesn't speak. We don't hear from her. She's passive in the following. Not only vatilakach, but how does she end up with Mordechai? Velekcha otah. Mordechai takes her, she's taken, she has very little agency. I think where she's the heroine in the story is when she ends up in a position of relative power, she completely takes over masterminding the plan to save the Jewish people. You see her go from silent, and Mordechai actually has a different plan, and she rejects it. She comes up with her own plan, uses a very feminine approach to accomplish it. And I think she quickly goes from victim to a person of enormous agency, and she takes charge of the whole process, goes against Mordechai. And that, I think, is a feminist success story here. Do you accept that? Okay.
Accept that, and I think it's interesting, Jay, that you've pointed to the way that she's able to do that when she gets a little bit of power. But you know, which is interesting. Maybe it's not fair to ask people who don't have power to also demand agency when you're not power. You know, to call for a miracle in that way. Yes, Bob.
I was struck by the contrast between Vashti and Esther. Vashti also says no, but she doesn't succeed. At least as far as we know, she doesn't succeed. She says no and doesn't leave another. I mean, Esther's no, as you make out, is ambiguous. She says it's tantalizing. No, but there's something else tomorrow. come back. Vashti doesn't do that. But Vashti does not succeed in being successful, which, I mean, in a social sense, I can see this as the plight of many women. But the contrast in the story is striking to me.
It's easier to use no to mean ask me later than it is to me to use no and mean no. And to really, you have to be willing to pay a price for no. I think we've seen that in the headlines a lot. It's a shame that this is so much in the headlines, and even headlines that I didn't invoke explicitly from this week. But please God, this will help us to do something about these difficult issues.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.